The gentleman on the stairs wanted to speak, yeah.
Thank you. Just a small point for the socialist case, which I hope deserves expansion on, we'll see. I just think the ability and the want for automation are two different things, which I think we all need to be able to have a discussion about. Surely a socialist society is the only situation to which we'll actually all be able to have an equal case. I think we underestimate how much control the ruling class have and how much they can persuade and maintain and possibly combat open source in a situation where they will feel that their position is being compromised. I didn't really put that as a question, but
well, I think the question is implicit. Yeah.
Nice, thank you.
Of course, history is littered with examples of class conflict, which comes to a head where the interests of an owning elite are seriously challenged or undermined. And I've mentioned several times about armed force. Let's not forget that the armed force, which protects the rights of private property, carries the full force of law in present-day society, and that the law in turn carries the sanction of a majority electorate in, well, most parts of the world now. Certainly most parts of what's referred to as the developed world have to some degree or another a kind of electoral democracy. And when we go to the polls and we vote for one of the major political parties, we are giving our voice to the idea of the present social relationships of capitalism in one form or another. So therefore the majority of the population is giving its consent to having private property protected through armed force. I'd just like to say one other thing about this, which is that the Socialist Party, of which this is the office is, was formed in 1904, and actually since that time has been incredibly consistent generally, but in particular there's one point which we haven't had time to focus on tonight, which is in the meaning of what socialism means, as which would be a practical future society, which can, I say future, it can be present if we make it present. But in that socialist form of society, because resources, productive resources, would be owned in common, democratically controlled throughout the globe, this would allow a system of production for use, not profit. And that's something we haven't had time to focus on yet tonight, but it's very important. So I hope there'll be time to talk about that. But production for use simply means that once productive resources are owned in common, we can start to create wealth purely for the use of human beings who need it, whereas at the moment wealth is actually produced only if and when there's a chance of it being sold at a profit.
Can I just add from the end of that one, by the way, that I was going to wait until the future, I'd like socialism now, at least.
Yeah, I correct myself, not future society. Okay. A potentially present society.
Okay, I'm only going to allow one answer from each. Oh, sorry, you haven't spoken yet.
No, I haven't.
No, I'm sorry. Do beg your pardon.
It's all right.
I'm getting anxious at all these people I've got in my head.
Right.
No, please. So, apologies.
I think we all need to understand the process of why certain things happen, right? So I think we're confusing the root cause with a consequence. Private property is not the root cause of anything. Private property is the consequence of something else. And war expenditure is the process of something else. Why is there war? Why do we spend billions of dollars in war? And the reason is because we don't have distributed energies, so we have a centralization of power that wants to get oil from a resource-rich country to bring it over here so that a few people can control it. If you have a distributed system of energy where everybody produces a little and consumes a little, that thing becomes irrelevant. So there is no reason to go to war. And if you say territorial disputes or problems to, you know, cross-border between nations, there is no problem crossing border between France and Germany or France and Italy, but there is a problem crossing border between Mexico and the United States. And the reason is because Mexico is poorer than the United States. So the only way you can have a truly global society where everybody has access to a decent amount of resources and a good standard of living is by decentralizing all the sources of power. That's the main issue. Decentralization of power. And the only way to do that is by decentralizing the access to the resources that you use to live. That's the only way you can stop the negative retroactions and consequences that you think are the root cause. They are not. They are just the consequence of the fact that things can be centralized and they can be opaque. If they are transparent and open and decentralized, that cannot happen. So, there you have it. Well, at least my answer. And I think we need to understand also scientific process, right? We say that in a hypothetical system where, you know, people work to do something useful and we share resources, everything's going to be much better. I agree. But you have to understand that you have to show that it works, right? You have to prove that it works by actually having a community that realizes that and that makes it an actual reality and that can be an example for others. Otherwise, it's just wishful thinking. And even if it wasn't wishful thinking and suddenly 90% of the population agreed and we all voted for it, we're going to make shitloads of mistakes which could, you know, collapse the whole system because we haven't tried on a small scale first. It's like a four-year-old asking for a pony when she hasn't known how to take care of a gerbil. Right? You take care of the gerbil first, and then you get to a rabbit, and then you get to a dog, and then you get to the pony. You don't get to the pony first.
There was somebody else sitting. Actually, I think we've lost somebody. Did somebody leave just sitting there?
Yeah, somebody was there.
She's been waiting for a long time.
That's right. So Jacqueline, you're next. Thank you.
Just quickly, I really can't hold it back. I did hear you say, and if I didn't, I'll sit down immediately. Capitalism, the most efficient, it works. Did you say that?
I said
did
that.
Did you say that?
Can I answer?
That's what I'm asking.
Yes,
that's
but can I answer?
Jacqueline, would you get to a question, please?
I'm asking.
Yeah, but I'd like to answer.
Did you say capitalism is the most efficient, it works? That's what I'm asking.
Okay.
The sentence...
I want yes or no, because then I'll sit down if he says no.
Okay. May I answer?
Yes.
The answer, the sentence isn't complete. That's my answer. The sentence is, capitalism is the most efficient way of arriving to that particular solution.
Well, how do you know?
Hang on. Sorry.
Because it worked.
Hang on.
Right.
Because it worked.
Can I say something?
No, we asked you for a question, Jacqueline. Sorry.
I needed to know if I'd heard incorrectly. Allow me to educate myself.
Okay.
Thank you. War, poverty, hunger, homelessness, poverty, despair, misery throughout three quarters of the world. In the West, we live good, even on the crappy benefits. They are dying all over the place. How is capitalism efficient? Wake up.
Can I answer?
Hang on, let's not have any discussion across the floor.
So,
to the speaker, please.
We need to understand...
Sorry, can we have quiet over there, please? Let the speaker speak.
You have shut up me a lot of
times. I'm sorry, if you want to speak, you can put up your hand and I will come to you. I haven't seen it. If you want to speak, I'll come to you in due course. The speaker to speak now, please.
Thank you. So, if the objective was to give everybody on Earth a good standard of living, then capitalism wouldn't absolutely be, by the slightest, the most efficient thing. But that's not the objective that society has put forth. The objective was to grow the economy. That was my whole point. If the objective were different, then capitalism wouldn't be in place. That's why capitalism is in place, because what we care about is to grow the economy. And I challenge that assumption. I don't think the purpose of society is to grow the economy, is to make more stuff that we don't need, you know, to get money, to buy things we don't need, to work jobs we don't like. I don't think that's the reason we should be living. So I challenge that assumption.
Okay. You want to respond? No. Okay. Danny, you were next.
Well, first of all, I'm delighted to see so many people here. This is amazing. we talked about the open room, the problem. And where social relationship has come up. And it's well to know about a social relationship, because a social relationship depends on what we know about what we're relating with and who we're relating to. Now, genetics, paleoarchaeology, they've investigated our roots. And it's come up now that it's absolutely certain that all human beings share the same ancestors. So therefore, we are all members of one human family. Now, in a family that functions, as a family must if it's to be a real family, we bring according to our ability and we take according to our needs. Now, what we live in with capitalism.
I'm sorry, Danny, I'm going to ask you to come to a question, please, as I've asked everyone else.
I'd just like to make a point, and then the speaker's...
Yeah, but can you keep it very brief, please?
Yeah, sure.
Can you do it in the next half minute?
Yeah, we live in a society, capitalism. There's all kinds of spurious ideas, nationality, religion, skin colour. So what maintains capitalism is this huge case of mistaken identity. So what we need as human beings is to come to the conclusion that I've come to. When I take the scientific evidence and I realise that I am a member of the human family. And who you believe yourself to be determines what you want. And as a member of the human family, I want to bring according to my abilities and take according to my needs a family life. And until such times as we as a society come to that conclusion to identify ourselves correctly, have a common identity, we're going to be up the creek without a paddle. Because you cannot abuse, cannot exploit, oppress, coerce in any way those people you identify. And of course, capitalism can only exist when we identify one another as the other.
Danny, I'm sorry, I'm going to need a question. Do you have a question?
Well, I'm whether the speakers think that's an important
issue. Okay, all right. Yep, that's fine. So,
Cliff, would you like to?
Yep, I'm going to say that I agree that we are one. Potentially one human family of Homo sapiens. And when you say that in a family we bring according to our abilities and then we take according to our needs, that is a very interesting point. It's absolutely true, in fact, because a lot of the ideas of socialism, as it would be practiced as a social system, do replicate the most natural forms of human behaviour. I mean, many times as a socialist speaker, I've explained that in a socialist society, we have common ownership of resources. We don't have any money system whatsoever. We have free access to all wealth. And quite often, people will argue, oh, well, we couldn't do this. They've got the prejudices of capitalism so ingrained in their minds that they can't imagine a social system in which we act as sentient beings, human adult beings who can actually cooperate with one another as a mature species and do exactly what our friend on the balcony says. Contribute according to what our abilities happen to be at any one time, but then take according to our needs. This idea that in capitalist society we're allowed to consume wealth according to what we've put in some perverse way, doesn't really make sense in human terms. They're two separate issues. We each have certain abilities to contribute to society, and then we have needs that need fulfilling. And the two actually don't always match. They're two separate things. Somebody, for example, who is perhaps very elderly and infirm may have less ability to contribute in the way that they once did, but their needs are still existing. These two have got to be understood as two separate things. In the human family, in a socialist society, we would give according to our ability and take according to our needs. And that does mean free access to wealth, which works perfectly well, of course, in any communal situation. You don't have a family. If you have a family mealtime, somebody prepares a salad, for example, you have a large bowl of salad on the table. People have a self-regulating system in family groups where you take something that you need from the salad bowl. It's very, very rare that family members end up fighting over the remaining salad in the bowl, because there's just a self-regulating system. We can see what resources we have, we can see what our needs are, and this kind of approach can be expanded onto a social scale.
We are one family indeed, and we had hints of this for thousands of years, and we've known this scientifically for at least 60. And now, for the first time, we had an exponential growth of race and consciousness, right? And why is that? Because technology enabled us to extend the sense of family. So for the first time in human history, you have basically people knowing everyone on Earth because they speak on Skype, because they travel different places, and they see that we're all the same. And so if you take Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Natures, he shows how violence and racism and poverty has actually been decreasing constantly since the beginning of time. And the reason our perception of that is skewed is because we have better reporting of how the world actually is. So now we see people starving, lots of wars. Why? There are indeed lots of wars and people starving in the world, and we should be working towards the elimination of such things. But at the same time, there are also, compared to the number of people on the planet, much less people starving and having access to less resources than in the past. Now, there is a slight different trend within developed countries where inequality is increasing quite rapidly, and we have to, you know, take care of that as well. But on the global scale, we've never been so prosper. So I think we have to take that into account when we make those calculations. And we're moving towards a one global society, one global family. And the fact that we have these technologies to enable us to realize that we are one family shouldn't be underestimated. We should actually leverage that. Because look at this. I'm Italian. I came here because I posted on Facebook that, you know, I was coming to London. And, you know, some very nice people said, hey, would you like to have a debate with us? And I said, yeah, sure. So now we are expanding our consciousness. We're sharing ideas. And that's because technology enabled that. So we're moving towards a one global family. We started with being very territorial. The family was just people living within our, you know, the four walls of our house. Yeah. And then our family was our village. And then the family was a city. And then the family was... Imagine just, you know, 40,000 years ago, aliens were the people at the other end of the valley. Because you didn't have the technology to talk to them, and you didn't even know that they were the same species. We didn't have the concept of species, but we had the concept of others, meaning not us. And now, because technology has enabled the recognition that we are all one, we are moving towards a society where racism, where classism could be finally eliminated. And we should be using these opportunities to the best of our abilities, to move that forward as fast as possible and to share these ideas and this meme, to spread this meme as quick as possible so that the suffering is reduced in the fastest way possible. And I think we are working towards that goal together with many others who are not here today and, you know, who are doing something else. And if we can find common grounds and things to agree on and actually move forward in a certain direction, I think we can move even further and much faster by collaborating.
This is the second meeting that I've been to, the Socialist Party and Zeitgeist movement, and for whatever reason...
Hang on, please, can we come together? Can we come together, please?
The speaker, Federico, yeah? I find Federico at times...
Excuse me, can we have quiet up there, please? Somebody's actually speaking down here.
I found Federico an apologetic for capitalism with certain use of terminology like it works. And while it works, of course, millions of children are dying from starvation. And you're not one of them, obviously. You're okay? But let them die because for you it's statistics. So... As revolutionaries, no, I'm not saying you're, you know, as revolution, we, as socialist revolutionaries, we are socialists, we are thinking of the situation every second. It's not that we are saying hallelujah socialism and getting the job. I haven't had a job for tens of years, by the way. Fuck capitalism, yeah? And I mean it every sense of the word. Because, you know, a lot of people who kind of come here and talk, and then they go and get their job and their money and the, you know, consumerism and all that. Fuck them all as well. So, you know, well, really, I find you apologetic for capitalism. You are, to me, you are like a problem, okay, for socialism.
Have you got a question here?
No, I'm sorry.
Everyone else has been limited in time. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to limit you in time. So can you move to a question, please?
He says private property is not a problem. First of all, we didn't say private property. We said private property relationship. You don't understand. Private property relationship. It means there is a concentration of private property, which you call it centralization. And then you contradicted yourself. You know, by saying the problem is centralization. There is centralization because there is private property relationship. In that private property relationship, there is wealth accumulation and concentration. And consequently, increasing misery and suffering for working men and women across the fucking world. There are 3 billion people who are earning less than $2 a day. Yeah? And while you want to play with your little five-star game here and there, it's going to get
okay,
worse.
Okay, I need a question, I'm afraid.
I don't know a question.
Okay. All right.
Because he's not capable of answering.
Okay. Imagine
you can only make millionaires out of it.
Sorry, can you let him answer, please?
Imagine a policeman comes back from his job and he says, today, 5 people were killed during a shooting. And then somebody, you know, stands up and says, oh, you don't care about them, you murderer, or you could just let them die, right? Just because you're telling a story or reporting something, it does not mean you're endorsing it or you're being apologetic with regards to it. So, I not only have empathy for these people, but I've actually dedicated all my life to the reduce of suffering, and I've proved that with every second that I breathe by working for free on voluntarism, on starting movements, on giving lectures, on writing books and releasing them for free, on contributing to open source projects. And I'm not a hero, I'm just like any other guy, and there are hundreds of people, hundreds of thousands of people, or even millions of people like me, who are doing that. And I'm doing that to the best of my ability.
A priest is doing the same thing as well.
And we are sharing...
Let him finish.
And we are sharing many things. And we're working towards a common goal. So our goal is the reduce of suffering as much as possible and the increase in happiness and well-being of people. And I think each of us does that in the best way that they can possibly do that. And the way that I approach things is very scientific. If I can measure the impact that I'm having, and I can say, if I can change a 0.1% of a process that creates 100 million people starving, I'm factually saving, you know, 100,000 people. So you have to think about the large scale processes, and also how can you have an impact on society. So the way I live my life, and many other people like myself live their lives, is to do what they can in their own little environment, so their family and their friends, and I try to live by, you know, with those values. And also, I try to have an impact on a global scale. So I think we should really be thinking about how do we live our lives with some dignity, to the best of our ability, to have the biggest impact possible. And also, how can we measure the impact that we're having, so that we are sure that we're actually doing something and not just think we're doing something. And yeah.
Okay. The lady up the top there, who's been waiting so long.
So that's something in Irish I regret me when I arrived in Milan all those years back. But the point is that Federico doesn't take into account, for instance, the nature of human beings. Because what we do with greediness that leads to the accumulation of resources and resources.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes that the group richer and richer by the day. How do you eliminate that? How do you change that extreme for the two communications. Sure, he has his hands as well in the drug dealing, because that is a very big issue in Mexico and all the West world. If drugs were legalized, probably a Slim going to be less rich. And thirdly, there is the other issue that is not a little matter. What we do with population explosion.
Okay. So the first, what do we do with greed? How do we eliminate greed in human nature? I think thinking in black and white, how do we get, you know, or everybody doing something or nobody doing something is, I don't know, not a serious approach. I think a sensible approach is how do we minimize a certain behavior, and which, you know, which you consider not to be beneficial for people, such as greed. And my answer is, you look at the conditions that create greed and you try to get rid of all those conditions. So if you allow for a system that centralizes power, then greed is inevitable, is a consequence of the fact that you have these conditions. And if you take away these conditions by creating a society where you share resources, where you help one another, where you share knowledge, where information is free, where collaboration is the number one priority instead of mindless competition, then greed becomes less and less relevant. I don't think you can get rid of that totally, but you can reduce it to the minimum, which is, you know, the best you can do according to your ability. And we have proof of that because there are projects that have thousands of people collaborating, and, you know, there is the one that wants more power and more power. But if you create a system where it's actually impossible for one person to get too much power inside that system, you're essentially eliminating greed and bad behaviors by design. So if you try to join the Linux kernel development, for instance, which has a huge impact on humanity, there is no way you can get greedy in there and control everyone else, because it's decentralized by nature. So it's impossible to be so greedy in a system where people share resources and collaborate together towards a certain goal. So you have to think about the design of things and how things come to be, instead of things just are this way or are not. How did they come to be that way? That's the question that I ask myself. And how do I change the conditions that lead to that conclusion?
By biotechnology, changing the human genome?
Okay.
I think on this occasion, Federico is right to actually locate the cause of forms of human behavior in the material circumstances that we find ourselves in. It's very true that in any particular social environment, certain forms of behavior are more likely to take place. But I would ask him to consider extending that same principle to the broader argument, because we were saying earlier about whether the root cause of the problems we face in society is private property relationships, the fact that some people own and some people don't. Federico has said constantly that that's not really the root cause. He said that capitalism is a symptom rather than a cause, and it's a symptom of something even deeper, which according to him is the desire for centralization, the desire for growth. We need to change these attitudes. We need to stop. We need to re-educate ourselves not to desire growth, not to desire centralization. Now, when he speaks in those lines, it's a kind of an idealistic formulation in philosophical terms, in which he's putting the idea before the system of society. It's actually saying we need to change our ideas first, and then we build a system on those new ideas. But I don't think that's realistic. I think the more realistic path is the one that he's giving in answer to this question, which is actually that you change the social environment, you actually change the physical reality that we live within, and by doing that, you will then change the behaviour and the attitudes and the desires. So this is the debate we need to think about. What comes first, the social system or the attitudes?
Can I just quickly, because it directly relates. I think we came to an agreement, because it's both. You change the attitude and the behaviour by actually building a society through technology that allows you to do that, to test it and show that it works, and then expanding it. And we have examples of these. There are pockets of populations that are building self-sustaining communities using shared resources and communal living and using open source technologies. So you do both things simultaneously, and that's the only way you can do that. Because technology by itself is inert. It doesn't do anything. You know, this thing just sits there. And so does a gun, right? It's the intention, what you do with the technology. So if you take the right values and you couple that with the right technology and you put them together, you can build a system that works, you improve on that, and then it expands. And just like a virus, but like a good virus, it spreads virally around the world eventually, and it works. And I don't think it's unrealistic. It's actually very much practical and pragmatic. You start with something small, and then you improve on it, and you know it grows. So I think, I mean, in my mind, we came to an agreement.
I don't think so. I don't agree with that. I don't think we do agree, because basically these small examples that you talk about, these pockets... Excuse me, do you mind? These pockets of what? It's not socialism. It's not really a common democracy in which we control resources. What is it? It's somebody gardening in their allotment, or it's somebody scraping together something with almost zero resources and with zero numbers of people. Let me go back.
That's just not true.
I think he's disappeared. But the guy who asked the question, which we're now both trying to answer, who I think has disappeared since. But you know, when he there he is. Yeah. Let me go back to what he said though. When he says, fuck jobs, and I don't bother with jobs, and I say, I can't agree with that. The fact is, as long as capitalism exists, anybody who is struggling to survive, as most of us are, with any kind of semblance of comfort or normality, is under extreme pressure to live through capitalist relationships, to go to work for a wage or salary, to go shopping in Tesco's, to do all the things which, in one sense, we hate doing, but which we're surrounded by. And I've been told so many times, I've been actually taken to task by people who've said to me, you call yourself a socialist, but you go shopping in Tesco's, or you go and work for a wage. Let's be clear about one thing. Being a socialist doesn't mean leading by example. It's completely unrealistic that we live in an extremely all-encompassing world of capitalism. The best thing we can do as socialists is to actually form the idea of what the alternative is as something that needs to be discussed and proposed and planned. But the idea of socialism within capitalism, unrealistic.
Listen. If you're intelligent, as I'm absolutely sure you are, you'll find a way of working it into an answer to a future question. All right? Okay. Okay. So don't lose it. But I want to get the floor sort of coming. Now I really have to apologise. Somebody in this kind of quadrant was just actually had his hand up about. I think yes. Okay. Yeah.
Just briefly, one comment, one quick question. I applaud your standpoint on work because I abhor wage slavery, and I realise from the position of not working now, being retired, I never really had time to work any bloody way. Okay? Now, but the thing is that given there are billions of people in the world who are powerless, some not even being able to read and write, even in understanding the environment, the police by, armies by, security forces, by you name it, and they step out of line, they're obliterated, the United States sends a few more weapons of mass destruction, courtesy also of our government, etc. Are you seriously telling me that the capitalist, powerful capitalist, imperialist class are going to stand by and allow these peasants, I'm talking metaphorically, going to allow them to gain control of this labour-saving open-source that you're talking about? Are you seriously saying they are going to allow that, given the overwhelming power that they've got?
Obviously not.
So I think there are two answers to this. One is they might not have a choice, meaning that if you start a process like that has an avalanche effect, it doesn't matter if you put obstacles in there, it just goes. And the fact that we've been moving towards a society that's more free, more open, more transparent, where knowledge is more shared, and we know more things about the government, what people do, and despite the fact that, you know, there are still about a billion people struggling to survive because they live on basically nothing, less than $2 a day. Poverty has been decreasing, okay? Suffering has been decreasing. In India alone, they went from, I think, 800,000 people dying of polio to zero. And that's, and I'm not saying this, you know, with lightness in my heart, but it's all thanks to Bill Gates. And I'm not saying Bill Gates, you know, is the hero, is the good guy. He started Microsoft, and I'm for open source. But you have to put things into context. There are lots of people who are very powerful and very wealthy, who could be spending, you know, they have this humongous properties and 10 jet skis and 50 boats. And Warren Buffett lives a very frugal life. He goes around with, you know, the bus. And he lives in the same, he's been living in the same house for 45 years, and he doesn't buy anything fancy, and he pledged 99% of the whole of his wealth, which is dozens of billions of dollars, to social responsible programs to eliminate poverty. Now, this is not wishful thinking or, oh, he's just doing, you know, to put up a good face. That's 99% of what he owns, with, you know, still with the 1% he keeps, it's still more than enough for himself, his family, and, you know, generations to come. Well, what I'm saying is, if we think of the struggle as us and them, and they are evil, and it's not going to work. First of all, because you're creating basically a battle within society. And second, because it's just not true. If you talk to these people, most of them are very decent, and they have the same values as you have, but at the same time, they feel powerless towards a system which is even bigger than them, even though they're so powerful. So Bill Gates has been using his immense wealth for the past 15 years, really, to reduce poverty and suffering in a way that I could never expect. Like, I hated the guy with a passion 10 years ago. And now I'm kind of like, yeah, but. Because, I mean, if you look at the reality, he saved more lives than anyone else has ever saved life in the history of humanity, probably, except for maybe Alexander Fleming.
And the other 14,999 billionaires that our friend Mrs. Slapper spoke about, where are they?
Sorry.
In this picture?
That's interesting, because they started a common pledge called The Pledge, where lots of billionaires are actually joining in. Mark Zuckerberg is joining in. There are about 60 of them who are now multi-billionaires who pledged that at least half of their whole wealth is going to socially responsible programs to end poverty. And of course, you know, you could say they're not really spending the money wisely or that kind of thing. So I'm not saying these are the good guys who are going to save the world. I'm saying it's not a battle us against them. We can be working together, all of us, towards the elimination of poverty and suffering. And we should be using all of the possibilities that are there. So I'm not being apologetic to these rich people, because obviously if they gained all that wealth, it was at the expense of someone else. But you need to understand the process, right? It's not like they stole physically from everybody. It's very complex.
Okay.
Could I just respond very briefly? I don't think that it's... I think Federico is right to say that these people aren't necessarily evil. And I don't think as socialists we've ever actually argued that the individual capitalists are evil. It's more about something that goes on in society separate from the wishes of the individuals involved. We're part of a bigger whole. We're part of a social system. The social system is something which exists, which is much bigger than any of us. And it's got its own history. Let's call it capitalism, for want of a better word. We live within capitalism. Capitalism molds and shapes everything about the way we live, because that's the social system which we live under. It has its own history. It came into being a few hundred years ago. It did, at the time of its birth, serve a useful function in increasing wealth production and growth. And at the time, it was useful. But it's outlived its usefulness. Even if we do as Federico recommends and drop the desire for growth, Either way, it's lost its usefulness. Capitalism, even if we actually hang on to the desire for growth, capitalism is a questionable way of achieving that. In fact, regardless of whether we train our desires to be pro-growth or anti-growth, none of that matters. The fact is, capitalism as a social system has outlived its usefulness on almost any criteria, and therefore it really has to go. So the fact that some of the individuals who actually own and control that system are making some efforts to act in a way that's socially responsible, they can't, even if they want to. By giving their money to socially responsible projects, that's fine, but that's still not actually changing the social relationship at the heart of the economy, which is one of employment. That's really the core issue. Is it employer and employee which dominates the productive process still? Yes, it is. And as long as that relationship exists at the heart of society, then all of the other problems that flow from that will still be with us.
A question. 5 seconds.
How many people want to speak? We got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. No, I'm sorry. We do need to get the floor involved. As I said, try and work for answering. Okay. Now, sorry, we've got two hands up here, but you've spoken before, so I'm going to go to people who haven't spoken yet. So you wanted to speak.
I got a question for Cliff. I don't remember the name, unfortunately, so I apologize for that. But there is a community.
The name of. No, you don't remember the name of...
Oh, a community in Spain.
All right.
Where the socialism is applied. There is...
Mondragon.
It's free.
Mondragon.
So there is money free. Everything is shared. When somebody's coming new, they build there to build the house of this person. So it's kind of shared in the community, even the house itself. So, but there is something similar is there something similar in the UK or in London?
The modern ones.
The short answer is no. There are small examples that we can point to of human cooperation, even within capitalism. Mm-hmm. I don't know a lot about Mondragon. People can look at the kibbutz experiment in Israel, for example. Of course, there are examples on record of people acting and living communally and working communally within a very limited sphere. But as soon as they then have to, as soon as they then need to draw on the rest of the society for raw materials, for resources, to interrelate with the rest of the world, that's where the problems begin. And therefore it becomes more and more obvious that a social, particularly now, in the modern world, we have a global village. And so that's why it's all or nothing. The world is it's a global system of society which we have today, of capitalism, and therefore any system of society that replaces that would also have to be global.
I guess my question is really, I have a question, not really an answer, but my question is really that I pose to myself and to the audience and the speaker, how do we actually reach our goal, right? Because we all know what the goal is and we agree. And the difference is, I think, how do we go about reaching that goal? And my idea is, you start with something that already exists and works and improve upon it and then make it better and expand it. And what is your proposal? In my mind, it doesn't matter who's right. It only matters if it works, right? So whatever works, that's what I'm going to propose and that's what I'm going to write. So if this is disproven, because it says, you know, it turns out it's bollocks, I'm going to say, oh, you know what, my first book is bollocks, we're going to do something else because that's what works. But you need a report system, something that actually tells you if your efforts are having an impact. And my question is, the Socialist Party has, you know, I don't know, 500,000 members or whatever, or a million members, I don't know, but do you have any numbers on how much are you going to grow in the next 6 months, how much you're going to grow in next year, 5 years, in 10 years? How do you go about realizing your train of thought? That's my question.